Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy. Hello and welcome everybody to the Banyan Books podcast and event series, Branches of Wisdom. I'm your host, Ross McKeechee, and very excited for our guest today, Dr. Jen Gunter. Before we get to her introduction, letting everyone know that although we have people joining from all over the world for these live streaming events, the physical location of Banyan Books is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Most of Banyan's podcasts and events are free. We welcome your donations to keep these programs accessible for all. You can just go ahead and click on the PayPal link in the show description below. Also, towards the end of our conversation today, we'll be getting to as many of your questions as we can for Dr. Gunter. One note is just to make sure that the questions aren't about personal medical advice. It's very difficult for a medical doctor to answer that, and as Dr. Gunter explained to me, can also be unethical. So we'll try and keep them away from too personal of medical questions. Thanks everybody for understanding that. Okay, Dr. Jen Gunter is the internationally best-selling author of The Vagina Bible and The Menopause Manifesto, and a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist with more than three decades of experience. Born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, she now practices medicine in San Francisco, California. The recipient of the 2020 NAMS Media Award from the North American Menopause Society, her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Globe and Mail, Glamour, and Chatelaine. She is the star of Jensplaining, a CBC Gem video series that highlights the impact of medical misinformation on women. Her TED Talk on menstruation was the third most viewed talk of 2020, and she hosts the podcast Body Stuff with Jen Gunter from the TED Audio Collective. Dr. Gunter is widely known as a fierce advocate for women's health. The Guardian called her the world's most famous and outspoken gynecologist. She believes an empowered patient requires facts to advocate for their body. Today, Dr. Jen Gunter is with Banyan Books in conversation about her new book, Blood: The Science, Medicine, and Mythology of Menstruation. In Blood, Dr. Gunter offers a clear, no-nonsense guide to reproductive anatomy and answers all the questions you never knew you had about menstrual bleeding. With her expertise and trademark wit, Gunter debunks myths, challenges, and patriarchal attitudes toward this natural body process. This galvanizing book dispels the shame, mythology, and misinformation around menstruation with scientific facts, medical expertise, and a fierce feminist perspective. If you'd like to learn more about today's honored guest, you can please visit her website, which is drjengunter.com. And she has a new blog on Substack called The Vagenda. You can visit that at vagenda.substack.com. So, Banyan community, a warm welcome for Dr. Jen Gunter.
Hello.
Hello. I think your mic might be muted. Oh, there you are. Hello.
Hello. How are you? Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm well. Yeah, thanks for coming. Great to have you. So I think, an appropriate place maybe to start is how patriarchy has influenced our medical system and the research in medical science. Can you talk a little bit about how that has impacted our knowledge around women's health?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been a unfortunately driving force behind how we've studied or have not studied well enough women's health. Since the beginning of Western medicine, women were viewed as sort of defective men, basically. The idea that, menstruation was a sign that we couldn't balance our humors, right? So if you look at the ancient model, it's all about balance. And so, well, if you're leaking fluid once a month or so, obviously you're not in balance, right? So everything was viewed through that lens. And as medicine sort of peeled off from religion when the germ theory was identified and, we sort of developed, what we would know today now as the scientific method, a lot of things didn't really change. Things were studied in men and were really not studied very well in women. The idea that, women have different physiologies, for example, the menstrual cycle with the hormonal changes, that wasn't discovered until, the early to like 1920s, right? So, you're kind of behind the eight ball with that. But so the idea that women should be included in studies not just about, menstruation, but about heart disease or lung disease, idea that there could be a difference, and you don't know if you don't study, that sort of permeated all of medicine. And then after the thalidomide crisis, I guess that's the best way to describe it, in the 1970s, in the United States, that was kind of used as an excuse to not include women in studies at all. Right. And it wasn't until 1993 in the United States that, that decision was sort of reversed. And the idea that, that if a drug was going to go to the FDA or if you were going to get funding from the government, that it had to include women, if it was appropriate for the study. So, we're getting there, but obviously we know less about a lot of basic physiology for women than we do for men.
Well, it's shocking. 1993.
Yeah, I was already out of medical school, right? 1993. And you can certainly understand, I mean, the reaction to thalidomide. I mean, that was a very horrific time. And for people watching who don't know, it was a drug that was, promoted for morning sickness and caused terrible, what are known as limb reduction defects. And so babies were born without arms and legs. And it was really terrible. And it was only because of sort of one person in the US at the FDA who didn't really like the drug, thought there was an issue with it, that thalidomide didn't get approved in the US. So it was sort of a fortunate escape from a bad part of history. So
Yeah.
yeah, so you can understand where they came from, but that doesn't mean that, you can't do better.
So you, like you said, you had already graduated from medical school at by 1993. So how much of your work have you had to really focus on learning and educating yourself in order to meet your patients' needs versus what you were actually learned in medical school?
Well, for example, the idea that women might have different symptoms with heart attacks, or they might have different response to medications for high blood pressure, wasn't even a concept that was discussed when I was in medical school, right? It just everybody has a heart attack the same way, but of course, everybody means, white men, really. That's what that means. So, as the studies come out, that's the one advantage of, staying very current is when you're very current on things as this new stuff comes out, you stay current with it. And, so obviously, I'm not current on lots of subspecialty medicine, but on how it, how all of these things are changing and evolving because of better science for women, I really do my best to keep up with. And, we're learning more and more, and we're learning it's, there are more complexities than we know. And, hopefully we're trying to do better.
Yeah. In preparing for this interview with you, I had some conversations with the women in my life to try and, gain a better understanding of their experiences. And hearing some of the stories, particularly of them when they got their first period, it really struck me how big of a factor the emotion of shame is. And that a lot of the challenges that they experienced could have easily been avoided if there had been more openness in the education system and from their families. I'm just wondering if you can speak to what you've experienced around shame in relationship to menstrual cycles and for women.
Yeah, I mean, it's still an issue. I mean, I think it's maybe a little bit less than it was certainly when I was growing up and even 20 years ago. But many women, I would say most women probably, if they're walking to the bathroom, do what I like to call the tampon Olympics, and they stuff their tampon or pad up a sleeve or in a pant or something so they can get to the bathroom without anyone seeing. But no one would think twice about blowing your nose in public, right? And I mean, that's actually contagious, right? It's not like someone's going to catch your period on the way to the bathroom. Like, oh, I'm going to throw it at you and throw it at you, and now you're going to menstruate. Like, that's not happening. So, yeah, it's a big issue. And, you know, we have a very destructive way, I think, that we consider menstruation in our society. You know, instead of requiring everybody to learn about it in school so you can do away with the shame, and if anybody starts to snicker, basically, you know, them being told, okay, everybody who laughs is going to stay after for a detention, and every laugh is a 10-minute detention, and if you want to be here till midnight, that's okay with me, I'm going to stay too until you realize that this isn't funny. You know, so I think that we need to set the right tone, that society exists because of menstruation, right? So every single person who's listening to this is here because of the menstrual cycle. If we didn't have a menstrual cycle, humans would have evolved in a different way. Our big brains are here because of the menstrual cycle. So when you think about it that way, and then you're penalizing half the population for menstruating, that would make any sense at all, right? You're giving them lower pay. You're telling them that they have to pay for their childcare. You know, I mean, obviously it's better in Canada than in the States. But yeah, it's, you know, education, knowledge is power, and education presented in the right way can help dispel that shame. Talking about it publicly, having events like this. I mean, I couldn't imagine 10 years ago, you know, being on, you know, on a podcast talking with a guy about the menstrual cycle, right? So it's really changing, and that's really good. But on the other hand, you know, there's two provinces in Canada where you have to opt in for sex education, right? Alberta and Ontario. And such as it is, I'm sure the sex education is pretty bad, but the very idea that it's not even opt out, but it's opt in, that's telling the parent that that's something so dangerous that we didn't automatically sign your kid up for it. You're going to have to do that yourself. It's really, you know, dark times ahead. People need to be very wary that what that does is reinforces shame, and shame reinforces the double standard, and that reinforces the patriarchy.
Yeah. I think about even just simple day-to-day things that for men are a non-issue, like just going to work every day and having the expectation, like when a woman is on her period, there can often be real challenges to even just show up and perform in the same way as you would on another day. And our system really isn't set up to accommodate that.
Well, our system was designed to accommodate, you know, a man who was working probably 12 hours a day, who then would have somebody at home taking care of everything, who had absolutely no, you know, responsibilities outside of working. And he would have worked, you know, 6 days a week likely too. So, you know, the way the Western working society was set up is very different. Now, obviously, there's many ways that people can be more productive at work with more flexibility. I mean, I would never have thought that a 4-day work week, people would have been as productive as a 5-day work week. I thought, that's no way. And you know what? The studies show that people are. And so, you know, so I think that we have to open our minds to have flexibility. I think one of the things is, you know, capitalism demands that we wring every last drop out of everybody. And so, you know, the idea that you're going to staff up to accommodate normal biology isn't something that our society is comfortable with or we're willing to pay for. So I think that, you know, there's going to have to be, you know, I think more reckoning, but starting to see changes is really good. And, you know, it's great that there are more workplaces that are willing to, you know, to have more flexibility and giving people sick leave. Sorry, that's my cat, Luna.
Luna.
Yeah, she doesn't see very well. So she has one eye. And so, you know, if there's a thump, it's just a missed jump, letting everybody know.
I saw her picture on your website in her Halloween costume.
Oh, yeah, Margaret Catwood. Oh, it's a thump. Yeah. So she went, she's like offered, because she's like, if thine right eye offends thee, pluck it out. And it's her right eye that she's missing.
Is
So
it?
she does have like a little, she has a little handmade outfit.
Oh, that's sweet. The first section of the book is titled The Menstrual Cycle, a Primer. And at the start of the book, you explain that menstruation is actually quite a rare biological process amongst mammals. You say, all told, less than 2% of mammals menstruate, although it's possible that number could be slightly on the low side. And you address the question of why we menstruate at all. I'm just wondering, can you explain to our audience the why of menstruation, as in, if so many other species don't require it, why do we?
Yeah, so it's really fascinating, and you think about us, we're all so different, right? You have elephants with these specialized trunks, right, which are their nose, and you have giraffes with incredibly long necks, and you have cats that can have these bursts of energy that seem like absolutely insane, right? So, we all have specialization in different ways to sort of meet the needs of our evolutionary environment. And so you want to think about menstruation kind of with that view as well. So menstruation evolved 4 different times in sort of mammalian history. And, things that evolve multiple times tend to be a benefit. And so, it evolved once for us and some of the primates, once for bats, once for the spiny mouse, and once for the elephant shrew. And so they're very, it's sort of a motley crew of mammals. And the difference, so all other mammals have estrus, which is a very different phenomenon. And it really boils down to something called decidualization, which is a term that most people aren't familiar with. So what happens in humans and for mammals that menstruate is when you ovulate, you release the hormone progesterone. And what that does is it prepares the lining of the uterus for implantation. And if no implantation happens, the body runs out of progesterone because it's produced kind of by the leftover shell, if you will, from the egg. And it runs out of progesterone, and that withdrawal of progesterone starts the sequence of events, and the blood comes out. And so what happens is the lining peels out, and then blood comes out with it, and that's menstruation. So why is that a value? So humans have especially, so we have heavier menstruation than the other mammals that menstruate. So for us, and obviously it might be a little bit different for other mammals, but for humans, the belief is so the lining gets very, very thick. That helps to basically provide, if you want to think about it, like a catcher's mitt for the embryo. Humans have incredibly invasive embryos. They're basically like cancer. They want to bury as deep and deep and deep and deep into the uterus as possible because they want to connect with maternal blood vessels because they want oxygen. They need oxygen to grow big brains. They want oxygen. They want to connect with maternal blood vessels. The problem is if that was unchecked, then would grow everywhere. And so the lining of the uterus, once ovulation has happened, it has the ability to actually modulate sort of the growth of the embryo into the uterus. So it's basically like a catcher's mitt. The other thing that happens with exposure to progesterone is that it sort of awakens this immune response in the lining of the uterus. And so many people have probably heard that, 70%, 80% of very early pregnancies don't implant and miscarry. And the reason for that is the human endometrium that's now had this what we call decidual reaction from progesterone, it can sense if embryos are highly abnormal and trigger menstruation to whoosh, get the embryo out. So, and there's, other things as well, but those are kind of the two biggies. And so people say, well, then what happens if you have estrus? Well, with estrus, the trigger for decidualization happens when the embryo contacts the endometrium. So the embryo is the trigger. So you're getting pregnant regardless if the embryo is there. There's really no quality control there when you have estrus. And so obviously if you have a litter, if you can reproduce multiple times a year, your sort of control of your population happens at a different level, right? So that's the difference. And it's there's no, because the embryos aren't that invasive, it doesn't need to have that decidualized endometrium waiting there as a catcher's mitt. And so because decidualization with estrus doesn't happen until implantation, if there's no implantation, there's very little lining to come out so it can be absorbed. But humans have the super thick lining, and in addition, the tissue, once it's exposed to progesterone, it actually undergoes a real physical change. And so if anybody who has ever menstruated and looked in the toilet and said, "My gosh, that looks like liver, a chunk of liver came out of me," that's decidua. It's organized and it looks like tissue. And so you can't absorb that, and the only way to get rid of it is to get it out. So that's kind of in a nutshell the difference between menstruation and estrus and why it's so unique.
Wow, it's really fascinating. It's
Isn't
quite an
it?
amazing process.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's obviously it when you're when it's happening to you, it's really not biologically interesting at all. Or it wasn't to me anyway. But yeah, as an evolutionary concept, yes, this idea, you know, humans have a very, very meta pregnancy for humans is incredibly metabolically taxing. It's the most metabolically taxing thing a human can do is be pregnant and breastfeeding. It's on par the energy requirements with like doing the Tour de France, just to put it in perspective. And so there's a limit to how many calories you can actually absorb. Like your gut can only absorb so many calories. So pregnancy is right at that kind of limit. And so it's sort of the human metabolic limit. And so you're taxing your body for that. You're taxing your body for breastfeeding. You're taxing your body for delivering a pregnancy. And think about it 10,000 years ago, right? You then have to deal with the blood loss. You have to deal with possible tearing and things like that. And then you have this kid that can't take care of itself. You're not an elephant or a giraffe that dropped a baby and it's on its feet, you know, in like 3 minutes, figuring out how to run, how to process visual stimulation. Humans are like useless infants. Like they can't do anything, can't even hold their head up, right? So they require so much care. So to get a human to the point where it could act like a baby elephant or act like a giraffe, follow you around and sort of help feed itself. Well, that's not till it's about like 6 or 7, right? So if you're thinking about putting all of that biological effort into raising an infant, you really need to make sure at the beginning that, you know, that biological effort is worth it. Again, you're a gerbil, you can have a litter of 10, you can have, you know, you can have a litter, you know, every 2 months. And so, you know, it's just different ways to achieve a different outcome, you know, or different ways to achieve the same outcome, I guess.
Right. Okay. I just want to take a minute to remind our live audience that Dr. Gunter will be answering some of your questions in the last 15 minutes or so. So go ahead and type those into the comments field. Chapter 5 of the book is called Reproductive Hormones, a Handbook. And I just want to share a quote here and ask you a question. You wrote that there are people with medical conditions who have their concerns ignored. And there is also inappropriate testing for hormones. Both of these statements can be true, and they are both reasons why I wrote this book, so people can learn about their symptoms and advocate for the right testing while also learning what isn't helpful, as unindicated testing can often be harmful. I'm wondering if you can help us understand this a little more, because the nuances here, because I really like your pointing to two apparently contradicting points of view and saying that both can be true.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is absolutely true that people come in and they have their concerns dismissed and they should have had testing. But it is also true that people come in because of what they've read online or heard, usually from naturopaths, that they absolutely need to have a hormone panel done and this and that to check their health, and they don't. And the problem is they've heard stories of people who've been dismissed, and so they think that they're being dismissed, right? So it's really hard, and that's why you need to learn more about your body. And here's a great example. So you're 32 years old and you haven't had a menstrual period in 4 months. You absolutely need to have blood work done because we need to know why you're not having a period. So every test that's a diagnostic test. So there's screening tests like screening for cervical cancer, screening for colon cancer, you know, those are different. But diagnostic tests, a diagnostic test answers a question. The question is, why am I not bleeding? Why are my periods heavy? Why do I have cramps? You know, why? Or the question could also be, I'm on this blood work and I need to make sure it's not harming my liver, right? So there's all different kinds of questions that a diagnostic test can answer, but there should be a question, right? Am I developing an infection, you know, for blood work that's followed in the hospital? Have I lost too much blood, right? So there's a question. So for our 32-year-old who hasn't had a period in 4 months, the question is, why have you not had a period in 4 months? So there are lots of different things that could be. It could be primary ovarian insufficiency, which is kind of like premature menopause. But it could also be because you're not taking in enough calories. It could be because you have a thyroid disorder. It could be because you have abnormal release of prolactin. It could be because you're on a medication that's affecting prolactin release from your brain. So prolactin is another hormone. And there's other reasons too. Right? So you need to know that because we would treat that. We need to know, first of all, if it's a prolactin issue from your brain, we need to know, well, is it a brain tumor? What else is causing that, right? So that needs to be investigated versus a 32-year-old who comes in with fatigue, who's having a regular menstrual cycle. She does not need her hormones tested because I know her hormones are within the normal range because she's having a regular menstrual cycle. And her hormones are not going to help me answer the question as to why she's fatigued. So what happens though is people get those tests done and then they come in and they want you to interpret it. And I say, you're going to have to go to the doctor who ordered it or the naturopath who ordered it because it's not indicated in this situation. It doesn't matter if they're high. It doesn't matter if they're low because your reproductive hormones change every single day of the cycle. So I could catch you right when you're ovulating and have a super high level of estradiol. And if I did it on the first day of the cycle, your estrogen level might be very low. Both of those are normal. And so tests have to be put in context, and you have to have the right context for ordering them. And so that can be a really hard concept for people. And I know that lots of doctors end up just ordering tests because it's easier. And that doesn't help anybody. You know, testing is often equated in our society with being listened to or caring. And it's not. It's answering a question. And if somebody did the wrong test for you, or did a test you didn't need, they didn't care about you. They cared about making money. They cared about getting you out of the office. They didn't have the knowledge to tell you why you didn't need that test. So that's why it's really important to be educated, because it's easy. People come in and they see a test on a piece of paper and they think it means something. But if the test wasn't indicated, then it doesn't mean anything. I mean, one of the things in medicine is if you don't want an answer to the question, you know, don't do the test. You need to know what you're testing for. And I would say that back in the day when I did my national accreditation, you know, when you graduate medical school, you have to do a national exam, or you used to have to when I graduated. I don't know if you still do. And we had this thing called a magic marker test because, you know, computers were like not, you know, there. And so you got these scenarios where you would read about a patient. And then you, if you wanted to order a lab test, you use the magic marker to get the results. But if you ordered, so you could uncover every lab test, but if you ordered tests you didn't need, you lost points. So you could technically get a zero on every question for ordering tests you didn't need, right? And so we were really taught, where I went to medical school, about the value of ordering the right test and how you were doing your patient a disservice for ordering the wrong test. And you were also burdening the healthcare system with tests that didn't need to happen. A great example is vitamin D. So many people come in and they want to get their vitamin D level checked, and there's almost no indications for doing it. And it costs, you know, millions upon millions and millions of dollars. And so inappropriate testing then can also lead to people who have to have tests they didn't need to have. And I'll give my own health as an example. So I was very, very sick in November. I thought I had COVID. I didn't. But I was so ill. I had to go to the emergency department because I couldn't swallow. That's how bad my sore throat was. So I hadn't had anything, any fluid for, you know, over 24 hours. I was really dehydrated. I had to go that. So I couldn't swallow. And one of the things that's on the list of bad things that can happen when you can't swallow is you could have something called epiglottitis, which is you could have this swelling in the back of your throat that can kill you because it gets so bad that it can occlude your airway. And I was drooling, and that's a sign of that. So they needed to do a CT scan to make sure I didn't have epiglottitis. That's the question. So, unfortunately, on the CT scan, great, I didn't have epiglottitis, fantastic. They found out I had a mass on my thyroid. So then I had to have an ultrasound to look at the mass on my thyroid. And the ultrasound was concerning. Maybe cancer, maybe not. 20% chance. So then I had to have a biopsy of the nodule on my thyroid to prove that it wasn't cancer, and it wasn't. So I had to have all those additional tests and all that additional worry because of a nodule that if I hadn't had that CT scan, I wouldn't have known about it and it wouldn't have caused me any harm. And so there, and obviously I needed the CT scan, so it wasn't done incorrectly, but it's just important for people to put that in context, is that sometimes when you get lab results you didn't need, you then have to follow it through to the end. And now people are ending up with other tests and other things that they might not needed to have had.
Okay. Yeah, there's really a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the internet makes people think that medicine is super easy and you can just go in and ask for these tests or that test and you'll have the answer. And with all this birth of these sort of internet hormone clinics and internet weight loss clinics and internet this and internet that, the whole sort of science of medicine, I would say it's also an art, but the whole looking at the whole person and understanding, a test in context is being lost. And especially in the States with all of this online clinics that are popping up, the way you get people to sign up for your online clinics is you order tests that they think they need, and so you can get them as a customer. So I'm not saying they're all bad like that, but I'm just saying like testing doesn't necessarily mean caring.
Right. Okay. Well, this brings me to, I mean, can we talk a little bit about wellness influencers? I know this is something that you tackle a lot on your social media, and it's really important. Like, as you said, I mean, not all of it is bad. Some of it is. And I always wonder because, like we were talking about the patriarchy before and how that's influenced the medical system, and of course, pharmaceutical companies have there's a lot of mistrust around them. And I feel like there's been a loss of trust for the medical system that may be justified in some ways, but also that gives rise for a lot of potential charlatans to take advantage of people who are looking for answers, where maybe they're not able to find solutions in with their mainstream medical services. So how do you try and address that as a medical doctor in a way that can be helpful for your patients?
So it's generally not possible to address in the office. It's really not.
Right.
If people come in and they've spent $10,000 with a naturopath, they don't want you to tell them, "Well, you just wasted $10,000." I mean, I know you did, because that's why you're here seeing me. I mean, I'm a subspecialist. I see people who don't get better because of, other care they've had, right? So, and what's really sad is I didn't need to do any of that $10,000 stuff. I know what they have in 15 minutes from talking to them, right? And that's what expertise is. So that's the difference. So you can't do it in the office because people get upset that, and that's my goal when someone's coming in to see me, is to make them feel better. Now, if someone says, "Well, I'm going to go to a naturopath and have these tests done, or I'm going to go have a hormone pellet implanted," then ethically, I feel I have to speak up and say, "Hey, hormone pellets are dangerous. They're not recommended." But if people have, to, you're almost never going to stop someone from doing that. So at that point, the sale has almost been made. So I think the better thing for physicians is to try to work on the system, to try to prevent that from happening. Trying to call out people when they're charlatans, trying to provide medical information, right? So a book like this would, if you're having problems with your menstrual cycle and you read this, you're going to be able to go to the doctor and get the tests that you need. So if you're that person who hasn't had a period in 4 months and your doctor says, "Well, you don't need to have anything done," you can turn to the page in this book that says that you need to have tests done. And you can say, "Well, can you explain to me why does Dr. Jen Gunter say I need these tests? Can you show me the guideline that says I don't need to have these tests? Because why would Dr. Gunter write this?" Now, you shouldn't have to do that, but that's a way to empower people. But yeah, I mean, if we want to fix the system, we need more family doctors. We need to give family doctors, adequate payment for the time they have to see people. When you have to see someone in 12 minutes, you can't give them any good care. You can look after a sore throat. And if someone comes to see you and they've got all these complex medical issues, you have to decide which one am I going to tackle today. And so the system is really broken. And the idea that you're going to like expand to go to naturopaths or chiropractors as a way to make up for that is, awful. You're going to go to people that have far less training and chiropractors, it's based on the person who invented it, got the info from a ghost. So that's really awesome. Right. So I think that the answer is, you have to ask medicine to do better. But in Canada, medicine is funded by the government, right? So you have to ask the government to do better. And Ben Goldacre, who's a physician in the United Kingdom, has the greatest quote about this in the world. And I wish I'd said this. And I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember the exact quote. But he says that if there's a problem with the airline industry, the answer isn't to invest in magic carpets. And that says it all. The answer isn't to invest in magic carpets. Every single day, I'm tagged in thousands of things on a thousands. It's a hyperbole, but I just someone just before I got on here, someone tagged me. Some influencer with 400,000 followers on Instagram is telling people that birth control pills will make you gay.
What?
Yes. So I'm like, well, it didn't work on me. Man, I was on the pill for 25 years. And you know what? Sometimes men are such a pain in the ass. Man, that would have been great. But no, I still like the men. It's but people hear that and they get scared and fear sells. And so wellness, anything that lies to you, anything that lies to women is the patriarchy. And wellness is just the patriarchy wrapped with a pink bow. That's all it is. It's faux empowerment.
I read a bit of your article on chatelaine.com. You were quoted as saying the following. You said, sites like Goop are especially bad because they do actually have some good information. But when you put shit next to quality, people can't always tell the difference. That's a really good
Right.
point. So, do you have any recommendations? How can we hone our discernment to know what is, pardon my French, shit and what is quality?
So celebrities are not your friends. Celebrities don't know anything about healthcare. Celebrities are trying to get attention. So if it's from a celebrity, it's shit. You should ignore it. Like celebrity, there's all kinds of celebrities who maybe lend their like, oh, I'm going to help fundraise for the Alzheimer's Foundation. Great, that's fantastic. You're Michael J. Fox, and you want to fundraise for Parkinson's. Amazing. Thank you so much for using your celebrity for good. So there are ways, celebrities, but wading into the, this happened to me, or I'm going to talk to this naturopath or this doctor, that is a way to get attention, and the headlines are almost always, the care. I mean, like for example, on Goop, you'll say, oh, you should eat more fiber. Okay, well that's good. And oh, you should exercise more. Okay, well that's good. And oh, you should drink raw goat's milk for the paras to cleanse the parasites in your body. Okay, so you've got a shit sandwich, right? You have two truths and a lie. And that's something that I don't know if this is I could be totally stealing somebody's stand-up act, but you start to see stuff and you don't know where you got it from. But it's like this is what they do on Star Trek. So they'll say, as said by Shakespeare, by Milton, and whatever, Gastroff on Rigel Five. Right. So you've got the one totally wild Star Trek name mixed in with two authors that you know. And so what happens is then you transfer the goodness from the true fact to the fake fact. And it's just rhetoric. That's all it is. It's rhetoric, using God terms, and devil terms and things like that. And so, yeah, so that's so avoid celebrities of things that are sold with like fear, words like detox, hacks. Like, first of all, there's no such thing as a detox unless you need to go detoxify from alcohol. And there's no hacks. I mean, unless it's like, what they don't want you to know is like eat 25 grams of fiber a day. So the sad news is, like, for example, the most healthiest diet for everybody is likely sort of a Mediterranean-ish diet, that's heavy in fish and plant protein. with 25 grams of fiber a day that has, less ultra processed food if possible, and, a limited amount of added sugar. Sure, have a piece of cake now and then, that's fine, but not every day. And how do you sell that? That's been the dietary advice for quite some time. There's been no revolutionary study that's shown anything else, but you need to write a book made up with all these fantasies about intermittent fasting or fantasies about acai berries or, because that sells and that's what the press wants to push. The press wants to push fear too. So, if people want to make a difference, don't click on that article that says the 10 hacks for, for hormone health.
Don't give it your attention.
Right. I mean, and it's hard. It's hard. But and I get it. I get swayed by a lot of that stuff too. But you just have to think about, and the other thing that we know from disinformation is that you have to fact check every single piece of information you get. And so if you think about yourself, you're on like Instagram or TikTok and you're scrolling through, you see a video and it tells you this piece of disinformation. And there's Luna. And it tells you this piece of disinformation, but the algorithm's pushing you now to the next video. You don't have time to pause and step outside and fact check. So that's why, especially like the reels on Instagram and TikTok, this fast video format, I think is especially destructive.
Yeah, the lack of depth and nuance and expertise, those three things seem like they're rampant.
Yeah, and I think humans want that. I think it's tapped into something very primal for us. Look, everybody wants the easy answer. Everybody does. I hate exercise. I hate it. I hate it. I've never once had a runner's high. When I'm doing Bulgarian split squats, I'm crying the whole time. I'm thinking, I'm gonna swear, I fucking hate this. It's so awful. But I know it's really good for me, so I do it. But telling people that they have to, it's hard to do. And so if someone told me there was a magic pill so I didn't have to exercise, I click on that link too.
Yeah. One of the things before we get to some audience questions, I wanted to ask you, and that's, I know you touch on this a bit in the book, is the mind-body connection. And I know that that's something that traditionally in our medical training there hasn't been a strong, maybe there hasn't been strong research in it. It's starting to come out more. Am I right? And is that a correct statement?
Well, I don't know what we'd say recently. I mean, certainly last 15, 20 years, I mean, I think it's been something that, especially in pain medicine, we've been aware of. Maybe it's kind of now percolating everywhere, but now we're aware of, for example, adverse childhood experiences and how that can have an impact on you later in life. We're aware that when you're scared, or anxious, that changes your brain chemistry and that can heighten the pain response. It doesn't mean it's in your head. A lot of these things we also know now because the imaging to look at how these things are connected didn't exist. I mean, when I was in medical school, they couldn't do the kind of neuroimaging that they can do today, right? Too. So, with each generation, we actually get new technology that allows us to look at things in a different way.
I guess the reason I asked that is because it seems like a lot of wellness influencers sort of almost prey on that gap in the medical service that a lot of people get, and they'll use the mind-body connection in a sort of vague way to try and sort of sell as something. Is that something you've
Yeah,
seen as well?
absolutely. And you're exactly right. So they use it in this very superficial way, but they don't like do anything else with it. Oh, it's the mind-body connection. That's why you need to take my supplements. Wait, what? That's really what it's like. It's like, okay, supplements like made in a factory because they're not picked off a tree, right? What are you even talking about? So yeah, I mean, I talk to everybody every day about the mind-body connection. I'm like, okay, like if you're not sleeping well, that is going to affect your ability to cope with symptoms during the day. And so days that you're not sleeping well, your symptoms are magnified. Does that mean that you don't have symptoms? Of course not. Does it mean it's in your head? No, of course not. But it means if we want to make you feel better, we probably should not just focus on your symptoms and the medical treatment for that, but maybe we should also talk about your sleep at the same time, because that would be the holistic approach, would be looking at the whole person. or if you have depression, or if you've had adverse childhood experiences, knowing that you're more likely to have certain symptoms later in life. It doesn't mean I can undo those symptoms, but sometimes people are like, oh, interesting. Like, people like to know the history of their, or the origins of their, you know, their medical ills, if you will. And being able to give people more puzzle pieces, I think can be helpful. Because when someone tells you you have like a medical condition, it's like telling you you're here on a map, but nobody's filled the map out and you don't know where you came from. You don't know if you traveled 1,000 miles, 500 miles or 2 steps. And so when you can fill in that map with more things, I think it makes it a lot easier for people in the long run. So yeah, I mean, I think that the mind-body connection is very real, not in the way that, you know, the snake oil salesman want you to believe, like, you know, use this whatever brainwave device to control everything, but, or take this supplement. But yeah, it's absolutely very real. I mean, your brain is where everything is processed and all experiences come in there together. So it would make sense that many things are linked and that we would need to look at many things to make you feel better.
That's great. Thank you. We've got some nice questions coming in from the live audience, if you're okay with tending to some of those.
Bring it on.
Okay. All right. EKG is the YouTube name, says, when someone is diagnosed with fibroids and told not to worry, it's normal, what is a patient to think?
Well, this is one of those things where two things can be true. You can absolutely have fibroids and they can absolutely be totally normal and not have any cause in your symptoms. And you can have fibroids and they can be something that are causing you great distress. So by the age of 50, about 70% of white women and 80 to 85% of black women will have uterine fibroids, which are benign tumors in the uterus. Fibroids can be very large and cause no symptoms. They can also be very large and cause a lot of symptoms. They can be very small and cause no symptoms, and they can be very small and cause terrible symptoms. So I would say the best thing that you could do would be to read the chapter on heavy bleeding in this book, which covers a lot about fibroids, and then it will help you understand if the fibroids that you have are concerning or they're just a bystander thing.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, EKG, for the question. There's one here from ES who says, why is it most gynecologists push birth control as the first line treatment for anyone with menstrual issues? I find this to be common with male gynecologists.
I don't think there's ever been a study that says most do that. So I can't really answer that. And I don't know if there's any difference between the way a male and female gynecologist prescribe. I'd like to think everybody practices evidence-based medicine. And the truth of the matter is, for many medical conditions, for people who don't want to have a surgical fix, hormonal contraception is the best answer. If you have heavy bleeding, for example, hormonal contraception will be the thing that will be the most effective at reducing your bleeding. Does it mean it's the only answer? No. And people should be offered all the options. If you're someone who has polycystic ovarian syndrome and you don't want to get pregnant, the estrogen-containing birth control pill is the most effective therapy for reducing high levels of the androgen hormones and reducing the risk of endometrial cancer, which is associated with polycystic ovarian syndrome. If you have painful periods, taking away periods with hormonal contraception can be helpful. If you have PMS, the estrogen-containing birth control pill has been shown to be highly effective, as have antidepressants. So it just depends on the situation. And for many of the medical conditions that are associated with the menstrual cycle, the birth control pill or hormonal contraception in general is very good therapy. Now, it's not always the only therapy and it shouldn't be offered as the only therapy, and people should get options for all, you know, they should have availed of all the options. So then you can decide the option that works the best for you.
You actually cover a lot about the birth control pill in part four of the book, Contraception and Abortion. And recently, Elon Musk tweeted about birth control, quote unquote, making women fat, doubling the risk of depression, and tripling the risk of suicide. And you responded by noting his ignorance of absolute risk in this assessment. Can you say more about what you meant by that and about general negativity around the birth control pill?
Sure. So I don't think anybody should be taking health advice from a man who wants to populate the world specifically with white babies. I think that's kind of his goal. So he's kind of Mr. Eugenics, and also who designed a car that you can't get out of if you back into water. So there's that. So it's always hard to combat somebody who's an idiot with factual information, because idiots like Elon Musk have no interest in having an actual, you know, if someone says the moon is made of green cheese, am I supposed to then, you know, have a good faith argument? And so when people are saying things that aren't made in good faith, you know, I think that it's important to point out that they weren't made in good faith. So, you know, the data that we have for depression and the birth control pill is very controversial. There is some data that shows a slight increased risk and others that show no increased risk. And if there is, if we take the studies at face value, then maybe for teens, there's a 1 in 200 risk. So, you know, if you go from you know, a 0.5 in 200 to a 1 in 200, you've doubled your risk. But you know, that doesn't sound a lot. Like an extra 0.5 per 200 people doesn't sound like it's very risky, right? The data is really difficult to sort out because it's certainly possible that for some people, the birth control pill improves mood, and for other people, it doesn't. And so that's averaging out as being a good improvement. And I think a great example is premenstrual syndrome. So people with PMS and PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, often feel great on the pill. They feel fantastic. We also use it for people with polycystic ovarian syndrome, as I mentioned, but they have a higher baseline rate of suicide. So none of these studies, because they're all sort of observational data that come from large databases, can account for those nuances. So it's more complex than someone who can't design a car that people can get out of when it backs into water could possibly understand. And so I cover it all in this book. And also, I'd add that postpartum depression is a significant health problem for people, and that you know, he doesn't seem to care about that. And so I would say to anybody, when you're starting to see these blanket statements about the pill causes this and the pill causes that, if that person is not also then talking about what happens to people who aren't on the pill, so for example, suffering from premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or suffering from menstrual migraines, or suffering from postpartum depression, that person has an agenda and it's not your health.
Thank you. Thanks. There's a question here from PG who says, how much attention is being paid to the connection between heavy periods and the effect on the heart? I have heavy periods and a congenital heart issue, and I notice distinct issues menstruating.
I don't think I can answer that question. I just don't think I can. When people have anemia and they have a low blood count, that can certainly have an impact on heart rate and impact on how they feel. And when their blood count's very low, that can cause heart failure. And someone with congenital heart disease may be much more susceptible, right? So if you look at what a heart that doesn't have congenital heart disease can tolerate based on, you know, a normal physiology, and depending, because there's so many different kinds of congenital heart disease, but say for, you know, say for example, you're, you know, someone who has already, you know, right ventricular hypertrophy, or you've got, you know, other, you know, significant issues, or you're having, you know, starting to have, you know, some, you know, degree of a change in your ejection fraction, things like that, you'll be less tolerant of anemia. So that would probably be the connection. And that's why it's super important to have heavy periods treated for everybody, but probably even more so for people who are at higher risk from having heart problems related to anemia.
There's a question here from ES who says, what would be some examples of non-birth control for someone with PCOS who wants to get pregnant or cannot take hormonal birth control?
So there is a whole chapter on PCOS in the book, and I don't think I can summarize that into a short section. But metformin is a medication that we often use for people with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and people who are specifically trying to get pregnant. There may be other things as well. For people who are have a lot of insulin resistance, exercise is very effective at reducing insulin resistance. And for people who are carrying around extra weight, weight loss can also improve ovulation. Now, this doesn't mean that being overweight is a cause of polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's absolutely not. but it can magnify some of the symptoms because of insulin resistance associated with obesity. So for people who are overweight, weight loss can sometimes be helpful as well. But again, I want to stress it's not a cause. What it can do is just magnify symptoms, because actually we know when you use strict criteria, the incidence of polycystic ovarian syndrome is the same regardless of weight.
Right. Okay. One last audience question from Vagabondita, who says, hysterectomies seem to happen fairly frequently. Are they only used as a last resort?
So hysterectomy used to be the most common surgical procedure. I don't know if it is a major surgical procedure. I don't know if it is now. So it depends. It depends on the situation. So obviously there's people who come in who have gender dysphoria and they want to have their uterus out, and we say, okay, I'm not sure I would consider that a last resort. There's people who come in and they have super heavy bleeding and they don't want to have children, and they say, I don't want to take medications. I want to have a hysterectomy. And we say, okay. And there's people who come in and they say, look, I don't want to have a hysterectomy. I want to try all the different options. Now, because a hysterectomy has the risk of complications, it's prudent for someone when they're talking to you about surgery is to talk about the risks and benefits and to also include other alternatives. So for example, if you have heavy bleeding, you might want to know that a hormonal IU, if you're 42 with heavy bleeding, you might want to know that a hormonal IUD is highly effective as well at stopping bleeding. And then that might appeal to you because maybe you don't want to have a major surgical procedure. I'm the type of person who sees people have complications from hysterectomies. So I always say to people, because I do chronic pain, if you had a complication from the procedure, would you have wished that you had tried one of the non-surgical options first? And in general, most people say yes, right? So you never know who's going to have a complication, but it can happen. People can have devastating complications. And if you do enough surgeries, you will eventually get people who have devastating complications. It doesn't mean that hysterectomy is unsafe. It means that all surgeries have a complication rate, and everybody thinks the complication is not going to happen to them. So how would you feel about that? I'm very big on choice, and we don't make people jump through hoops. Well, we shouldn't. Some places make people jump through hoops to have abortions, and some people don't allow it at all, some places. But you should get to choose if you want to have an abortion. You shouldn't have to have a 24-hour wait or a 48-hour wait. And I believe in having that kind of choice with everything. But choice should be informed. And, there isn't an alternative to abortion if you don't want to be pregnant, right? Or if you have a medical concern and can't be pregnant. But there are alternatives to, for example, hysterectomies for heavy bleeding, or hysterectomies for pelvic pain. And depending on the situation, it may be offered sooner, it may be offered later. It also is going to depend on what we call your comorbidities. So somebody who's at higher risk for complications from a hysterectomy, for example, somebody with congenital heart disease, we might be much more invested in pushing non-surgical options, or pushing is not the right word, but really saying, hey, this really should be a last resort for you because you're at much higher risk of having a complication versus someone who isn't. So it's complicated. And that's why knowing about all the options so you can make an informed choice is a good idea.
Another very nuanced and thorough answer. Thank you so much. I just want to remind our live audience, we've been speaking with Dr. Jen Gunter about her newest book, Blood, The Science, Medicine, and Mythology of Menstruation. And really, this is chock-a-block full of really in-depth information. So I think it's highly recommended. And of course, you can get it at banyan.com. Dr. Gunter, obviously you've been working really, really hard to educate people, and I'm really grateful for the work that you're doing, as I'm sure our audience is. And thanks so much for joining us today. Before
Oh,
we
I'm sorry. I was just going to say thank you so much for having me, and thank you everybody who asked questions and who's watching and listening.
It's been really nice to speak with you. And before we go, any parting words? And also, I think you're maybe working on another book. What's your next book about?
Yeah, so my next book is all about the legacy of sexism in medicine and how that we are still seeing ramifications of it today in all different kinds of ways. So this is about 3 years from coming out. So just starting to get the background research done on that.
Wow, that sounds like a big project.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There would be a lot more interviews in it. And yeah, I'm just really looking forward to it. I'm gonna sort of stretch hopefully my writing in different ways. And and the title of the book is Pandora's Legacy.
Okay, lovely. That sounds great. Any closing thoughts or final words for our audience before we say goodbye?
Yeah, if something is sounds too good to be true on the internet, it almost certainly is. And one thing I would say is that, I mentioned that it's really important to fact check, but it's hard to fact check with a Google search. In fact, a Google search is a really bad way to fact check if you don't know how to do it. And there's actually information in the book on how best to look things up online to try to get a better quality search result too.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. The show is edited by Abdo Habani. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.